The Tom Woods Show, episode 733.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, don't let yourself get kicked around in a debate. I've got a secret weapon for you, libertyclassroom.com, where you can learn real history, real economics from people like me and other folks I trust in courses you can listen to anywhere. It is the best deal in the history of the world, and because you're a listener of the show, I'll give you the secret, which is the secret coupon page, libertyclassroom.com/coupons. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here. I want to talk about some topics relating to families and children as they relate to libertarianism. There's nothing exhaustive about this particular episode, which I don't think will be super duper long. These are just some thoughts I had just from an article that I read recently that I want to tell you about, and also from reading what other listeners had to say on the subject of children and libertarianism. Because back, maybe a dozen or so episodes ago, something like that, I had Julie Borowski back on the show, and I asked her, what do you think are some areas within libertarian thought that are not fully fleshed out to your satisfaction, where you think we still need to do some more work? And one area in particular that we talked about in that regard was children. And it's a complicated question because, of course, the issue of when somebody reaches the age of reason has no definitive answer that is strictly correct for every single person. You have to be arbitrary to some degree. But there's been a lot written on children and among libertarians, maybe not quite enough, but among what has been written, there's been some stuff that has really, really disturbed people who are critical of libertarianism. A lot of times one of the things they'll point to is the alleged libertarian position on children. But actually, the conversation among libertarians regarding children is still ongoing, and there are a lot of academic papers on it. There's a lot of back and forth about it. So I wanted to say a little bit about that subject, and I want to start, actually, just because I just happened to read it and it's driving me crazy, with an article that is a little over a year old now, actually, but it's brand new to me. I hadn't seen it before. Maybe you did. And it's called, Is Having a Loving Family an Unfair Advantage? Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm reading an article with that title. But of course, you can understand why somebody would say that. The family is one of the great obstacles to the plans of the egalitarians. Because the work of Brian Kaplan, to the contrary, notwithstanding, it does seem to me that the role of the parents is pretty substantial when it comes to, you know, how the kids are going to turn out. I mean, I think that the way my kids are turning out has a little something to do with how we've parented them and the sorts of things we talk about at the dinner table and the kind of books that we read together and the ideas that we discuss. If we neglected them and we didn't treat them like they mattered or that their opinions matter or that they are worth talking to about important things, I think they would be different people. And this article is actually written about two philosophers, Adam Swift and Harry Brighouse. And they have some things to say about the family and egalitarianism themselves. Now, they don't say the family should be abolished and kids should be raised by the state, although they don't seem quite as appalled by that as, you know, regular people do. What they suggest here, and by the way, there is a strain in liberalism going back a long way that does believe that in order to have equality and in order to emancipate children from the superstitions of their parents, they really need to be raised in common by some, you know, state institution. There is that strain. And I'll get to in a minute the John Rawls question about his view of that subject. But What these two philosophers say is that there are certain relationship goods that families bring about, whereby families are good for children and good for parents. And those activities that parents carry out that reinforce these and promote these relationship goods, those can be tolerated. So, for example, reading bedtime stories to your children. Well, this can be a wonderful bonding thing, and this promotes these familial relationship goods. However, sending your children to an elite private school doesn't necessarily advance those relationship goods, so that should not be allowed, because that just encourages inequality. So they say, we could prevent elite private schooling without any real hit to healthy family relationships. Whereas if we say that you can't read bedtime stories to your kids because it's not fair that some kids get them and others don't, then that would be too big a hit at the core of family life. Okay, but you see how arbitrary that is? Why couldn't another egalitarian come along and say, well, I don't think the core of family life is so important that it needs to override egalitarianism? And how do those people answer that? If egalitarianism is your overriding concern, then why would something as vague as the core of family life trump that if you're both egalitarians? I don't see how that seems like a pretty weak response. But interestingly, one of these two, Swift, says, I don't think parents reading their children bedtime stories should constantly have in their minds the way that they are unfairly disadvantaging other people's children. But I think they should have that thought occasionally. Do you need me to comment on that? A person actually said that. A so-called philosopher actually said that. Now, let's say a little something about another much more well-known philosopher, and that's John Rawls, the very, very important liberal philosopher, and I mean left liberal in the American sense, philosopher of the 20th century. Because it was, he was asked about his opinions of the, or he raised the question of the family. He was very, very concerned about equality. He thought that inequalities could be permitted to exist, not because they had any right to exist, but only because they benefited the least well off. So it's okay for a doctor to earn a little bit more than a garbage man, because then that'll encourage people to become doctors and thereby give the poor medical care. So he's okay with that. But it's not because the inequality has any right to exist, only because it benefits the least well off. Well, Robert Nisbet, who was a Columbia University sociologist and a conservative, wondered about what Rawls's position would be on this. And by wondered about, I mean strongly suspected that deep down Rawls would have to say that if we really are serious about equality, then we have to get away from this inequality-generating institution, namely the family. And as Nisbet put it, I have always found treatment of the family to be an excellent indicator of the degree of zeal and authoritarianism, overt or latent, in a moral philosopher or political theorist. He traces out two traditions of thought in Western history. So one of them goes from Plato to Rousseau. Now, with Plato in the Republic, he advocates abolishing the family for the so-called guardians for various reasons. In the Laws, he does allow all citizens to be raised in families. He does think of it that way. He does have different interventions into family life. Rousseau is one of these people who believes that man is corrupted by institutions. He's born good, and he's corrupted by institutions. Well, the family's an institution. On the other side of this, there is a tradition of thought that extends from Aristotle through people like Edmund Burke and Alexis de Tocqueville. And this tradition views the family as being an important ingredient in social order, as being an institution, let's say, well, maybe Aristotle didn't quite think of it this way, but as an institution prior to the state, let's say, and that has rights of its own. Now, Rawls, though, if you read him, he seems to suggest that probably the weight of his argument seems to lean toward the idea that the family ought to be abolished in the name of equality, so that some people aren't raised in lousy families and other ones are raised in good families. That gives them a, an unjust advantage. He says, this is Rawls, "It seems that when fair opportunity, as it has been defined, is satisfied, the family will lead to unequal chances between individuals. Is the family to be abolished then? Taken by itself and given a certain primacy, the idea of equal opportunity inclines in this direction. But within the context of the theory of justice as a whole, there is much less urgency to take this course." Well, why not? Well, in fact, Robert Nisbet wasn't so sure that this was a, you know, particularly comforting assurance by Rawls. So Nisbet wondered aloud whether Rawls could long neglect the family given its demonstrable relation to inequality. Rousseau was bold and consistent where Rawls is diffident. If the young are to be brought up in the bosom of equality, early accustomed to regard their own individuality only in its relation to the body of the state, to be aware, so to speak, of their own existence merely as part of that of the state, then they must be saved from what Rousseau refers to as the intelligence and prejudices of fathers. Well, anyway, I share that article with you, and plus this extra stuff about Rawls and Nisbet, just to make the point that it's not a crazy conspiracy theory to think that there's a strain of thought on the left that is anti-family and wants to undermine the family. We didn't make that up. These people really did say these things. These people really do have ideas that lead in this direction. Now, normally, if you have ideas whose logical consequence is an outcome so appalling, such as the abolition of the family, that would make you rethink your initial ideas, wouldn't it? Unfortunately, not so for a lot of the architects of left liberalism. So that's some stuff that was sort of on my mind because I read that article about those philosophers. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/733. Well, the other thing I want to say just involves the question of parental obligations toward children, because it's very often claimed that the libertarian position is that parents don't have any enforceable obligations to their children, and that it would be perfectly all right for them to neglect their children, even to allow their young children to starve. Because after all, the argument goes, the central libertarian principle is the non-aggression principle, which says that nobody may initiate physical force against any peaceful person, against any person who is not a criminal, basically. So there are no positive obligations that you have in the sense that I can't enforce on you my right to a Cadillac, because that would actually involve aggression against you. I would have to enslave you to earn the money to buy me a Cadillac. So that it would not be allowed under the non-aggression principle. That would involve aggression. Well, the argument goes that although I can't take a knife to my children and kill them, because that would be aggression and I would be violating the non-aggression principle, simply allowing them to die by not nourishing them would have to be considered all right according to the non-aggression principle, because I haven't physically done anything to harm somebody directly, and there are no such things as positive obligations. You can't force me to do anything, because in forcing me to do it, you're committing aggression against me. You can stop me from doing something directly evil. You can stop me from lifting my hand with a knife and stabbing somebody, but you can't force me to earn the money to feed people and force me to go ahead and feed them. The same thing would go for even my own children, the argument goes. And libertarians have been tarred with this for a long time. But it's not obvious, actually, that that is the correct libertarian position. And it's not the correct libertarian position for the same reason that one might argue that abortion is not, allowing abortion is not the correct libertarian position on these grounds. The great example, analogy that has been used is that of an airplane. If I take you up 30,000 feet in my airplane, I have placed you, through my action, I have placed you in a condition of vulnerability. So once we get up there, if I were to say to you, hey, look, this is my private property, and I don't want you on my private property anymore, so here's the trap door, and out you go, and I'm staying in conformity with the non-aggression principle, because after all, you're no longer wanted on my property, you're trespassing, you're the one committing aggression. So all I have to do is open this here trap door, and out you go. And that is the correct libertarian position? Well, I think the way we would evaluate that is to say, if you take somebody and put that person in a vulnerable position, you are not allowed then to exploit the very vulnerability you yourself have created for someone. You made the person vulnerable by putting them up in the airplane. You can't now put them in a position where that vulnerability causes them to be harmed, physically harmed, and in this case, losing your life by perishing from being dropped from an airplane from 30,000 feet. Well, the analogy goes that in the case of the unborn child, also we have somebody who is in a condition of vulnerability. And you know, I won't get into the personhood thing, although I could. I mean, the argument there would be that the nature of the child doesn't change just because the size of the child changes, that the child is really eeny-weeny at the beginning or doesn't have fully formed organs or whatever. Well, that child is not going to grow into an oak tree. That child left to its own devices is going to grow into a full-fledged, healthy child with all organs. So the nature of what you're talking about does not change. So there is no moment where we can say, well, at one point this was a tree and now it's a baby. There's no, in that continuum from when the child is initially conceived to the birth of the child, there's nothing in the nature of the child that has changed. So it's the same child all along. And a child in the womb is likewise in a vulnerable position. And so if a child has been placed in a vulnerable position, then you can't say, well, too bad for you that you're going to perish if I yank you out. Can't work that way any more than I could yank somebody out of an airplane. Well, you can extend that logic beyond the question of abortion. And that's what's been done. In fact, some of my listeners did this in their posts on the subject that they wrote on their blogs. After children are born, they're still in a condition of dependence. Now, again, how did they get in that condition? Not through any fault of their own. And so if you put somebody in a condition of vulnerability, then you can't mistreat them in a way that exploits that vulnerability and that harms them, that causes them physical harm on account of a vulnerability that they themselves are not responsible for, that you are responsible for. And that thereby makes you responsible for them the same way that I would be responsible for somebody who's up in my plane. So that is one way that you can establish the idea, even just purely from libertarian grounds and not thinking about emotional attachment or just, you know, the normal sense of natural obligation that normal people have toward their children. Even just speaking on a cold, calculating, theoretical level, I think you can derive this idea. Now, then one of my listeners says this, and I'm not totally sure I go for this, but I thought it was interesting enough to share with you. Rothbard talks about homesteading, or parental rights, basically. And what this commentator is saying is, well, there are people who claim to have homesteaded something who really haven't. If I just pointed at a field and said, I've homesteaded that because I'm looking at it and I pointed to it, well, I can say I homesteaded it all I want, but I haven't really, because I haven't actually done anything. I have to do something to make that land my own. I can't just announce it. I can't point to it. So if I clearly had not used the land, then you could just as easily come along and say, well, look, I'm going to homestead it. I'm going to homestead it. Because you haven't really homesteaded it. So it's not homesteaded. I'm going to homestead it, and I'm going to acquire it for myself. Well, the argument is that suppose you see a child who is being neglected by parents, then this would be a similar case of the homesteading not actually having been carried out. In the same way that I would be incorrect in pointing to an empty field that I have not in any way transformed and saying to you, this is my field and I have the homesteading rights. Well, likewise, a child who has not been cared for, well, the homesteading of the parental rights has not occurred. And so therefore, that child can legitimately be cared for by somebody else on libertarian grounds. So if you start exercising parental duties over these children, then you have received the parental rights. That's the argument. I don't know, maybe there is something to that. That's an interesting way to think about it. I'll link to that also at tomwoods.com/733. Now, there are, as again, an author points out, other questions that are not so straightforward. I'm just going to read this passage. What constitutes neglect serious enough to consider parental rights abandoned? Does it have to be life-threatening or merely have a negative impact on the child's future? Then I would also add to this, at what age can we say that the parental obligations have been exhausted? The children are obviously not completely helpless as time goes on, but they still have some kind of dependence. And obviously today we would say that somebody who's 50 is not really entitled to shelter from his parents any longer. So obviously there's some point at which everybody would concede that the parental obligation comes to an end. I mean, obviously parents can still do things out of the goodness of their hearts, of course. But in terms of what would be enforceable, well, this is something that doesn't have a clear answer, that has to be arbitrary, whether you have a state or not. The answer is going to be arbitrary. Anytime the state does anything, you know, like voting rights, for example, and they say you got to be 18, there's some 12-year-olds who are bright enough to vote and some 30-year-olds who will never be bright enough to vote. So that's an arbitrary rule. Sometimes you have to settle questions by means of convention because the nature of the question will not allow a more precise answer. And so you have to have a somewhat unsatisfactory resolution of some questions simply because of the nature of the question. All right, now as I said, that doesn't answer every question. It's not exhaustive, but it gives you maybe something to chew on and see what you think about it. If you agree with it, if you want to elaborate on it, if you want to hash it out in the comments at tomwoods.com/733, whatever you want to do, but just some ideas that were on my mind. And I thought, well, I have a podcast, I got a microphone over here, let me start blabbing and see if something helpful comes out. So we'll have some links over at tomwoods.com/733 on this. All right, now, here it's funny that I'm mentioning young people in this episode, and it so happens that the website I want to highlight to you for today was created by a 17-year-old listener of the show who's been listening to the show for a little over a year. And he says he's been wanting to start a website for some time, and a couple months ago he finally did it. He used my link. He went to tomwoods.com/publicity, and it's called thelibertyadvocate.com. TheLibertyAdvocate.com. He says it's a website devoted to articles on subject matter related to libertarianism/voluntarism. I hope to put out a couple of articles a week. I probably won't be able to write as much as I'd like, but he's going to aim at a couple of articles a week. I've looked at it. It's articles on a whole bunch of interesting subjects. I went down, I read from the article on Bitcoin all the way back to the article on the 28 pages on the intelligence report about 9/11. So there's a whole bunch of stuff on there, plus war and non-intervention, and it's a 17-year-old listener. So for that reason, I think you should really check that out. I mean, give a 17-year-old a break. He's doing the right thing. He's probably outnumbered in terms of 17-year-olds. So give him a hello and a comment and a word of support over at thelibertyadvocate.com. And remember, I give out so many free goodies to people who start their websites through my link, but you got to start them through my link, and you'll find that at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, tomorrow I will have a guest with me once again. He's somebody who's never been on the show before, but he's somebody whose podcast episodes I've really enjoyed listening to. He's somebody who more often than not can beat me in chess, so I'm really narrowing it down who it could possibly be. But he's an awful lot of fun, and I know we're going to have a great chat. So look out for episode 734, and I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.